The latest figures show a disturbing fact about life in Florida prisons. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Florida Department of Corrections has released new data about inmate deaths, and the latest numbers show a sobering trend. Deaths are on the rise, and 2017 saw the most deaths ever recorded in 1 year. We'll look into the causes that the DOC is giving. Jackson Soul Food has been around for decades. We'll talk with a member of the family about why the Overtown restaurant has had such staying power, and we'll tickle your taste buds as we discuss true soul cooking. Then we go into the lurid world of Salome, the opera that was once banned in London and Vienna. We'll talk with two of the lead singers. The Florida Grand Opera production is this month and next in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. All of that coming up on Sundial, here on WLRN. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, there are problems at Florida's prisons. One of them is inmate deaths. You see, the number of inmates dying in Florida prisons is going up. And according to the latest data from the Florida Department of Corrections, 2017 saw the most deaths in 1 year on record. Add to that, there was supposedly going to be a prisoner strike, but what's really happening? Well, joining us now from the WLRN studios in Doral, we're joined by Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown. She covers Florida prisons extensively. Julie, it's a pleasure to finally have you on the program.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
All right. Let's focus on the latest report that came out and it was published in the Herald this past week. The number of inmate deaths rose by, what, almost 20% in 2017 from the year before?
That's right. Deaths in Florida prisons are at an all-time high. They jumped from last year. Last year it was about 350 deaths in the state prisons. This year that number is about 428. We're also noticing that the ages of inmates, the age of people who are dying, are getting younger, and that there are a lot of issues with the medical care still remain after years of us writing stories and exposing some of the problems with medical care in the prisons. It continues to be a serious problem. Drugs, gangs, violence, inmate on inmate violence also has contributed to the spike in deaths.
Yeah, I mean you touched on it because I was curious as to what the DOC is saying are some of the reasons for such a big jump in 1 year.
Well, those are the reasons. Essentially, the medical care is really still inadequate, the drugs coming into the prisons are just causing all kinds of problems with overdoses. We have more and more people that are being incarcerated with addiction problems, and more people who have mental illnesses, which all contributes to the mortality in Florida prisons.
This data, this comes out from the Florida Department of Corrections regularly, correct? I mean, is the data complete? Are there any holes in it or questions that you might have about it?
Well, you know, when the difference between the statistics as far as deaths versus people who are tortured, for example, and you know, survive, it's harder to hide deaths. Someone's died, they're dead. So they can't really, there's not a whole lot of doctoring they can do with these figures. What they can do is say, well, this was an accident or this was a natural death. They often do that for deaths that sound very odd, like a 30-year-old woman just dies unexpectedly and it's a natural death. It's pretty suspicious when that happens, and we see that quite often. So the causes of deaths and the manners of death, I think, sometimes are suspect.
Yeah, and how many of those deaths, by the way, are from last year are being investigated?
Probably at least half of them. I mean, we still have open, when I say we, I mean the state of Florida still has probably hundreds of cases still open from years that are still being investigated. They just don't. FDLE investigates a number of them, and we just there aren't enough investigators to investigate all these in a timely manner.
And you talked about the average age of inmates. The average age of the inmates that are dying is getting younger. Explain that.
Well, they haven't really come up with a reason why that's happening, but if you look at the population as a whole, with the opioid crisis that we're encountering in the nation, as you know, 68,000 people died last year from opioid deaths. And so when you think about it, more and more people going to prison for opioids, and a lot of them being young people, there's some theories out there that it could have a lot to do with the opioid crisis. There's also a problem with a drug called K2, which is also known as Spice, which is pretty rampant in Florida prisons, that has caused a lot of overdoses.
Yeah, this is fascinating and frightening at the same time, because maybe it's just an outsider's perspective. We look and say, well, how are drugs getting into the prisons? But this particular K2 that you talked about, this is made up of stuff that they're just using and making in the prison.
Well, they have to have some of it, some of the basics for it have to be smuggled in. Really, the main way that the drugs are getting into the prison is through the staff, the guards and the staff at the prison. It's really the main way that the drugs are getting in there, which is pretty horrifying to think that. But that's the way these officers are not. They're very young. They're not, a lot of them aren't trained well. A lot of them aren't paid well. So we're getting people essentially who worked at Wendy's 1 week guarding killers, you know, within a month or two of getting preliminary training. And they're not making a lot of money. And so that's part of the problem.
Again, we're talking with Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown. She covers Florida prisons, and we're looking at some of the latest information that's come out from the Florida Department of Corrections about inmate deaths, and they're up. They're up by 20% last year from the year before, and we've also seen that the average age of inmates that are dying is also getting younger. You also talked about health care, Julie, that some of these prisons don't provide very good health care. What's the biggest issue that jumps out as to what they do provide and don't provide?
Well, there's a lot of advocacy organizations that have been fighting tooth and nail over the years to get adequate health care for Florida inmates. Most recently, Disability Rights Florida won a lawsuit forcing the department to give inmates who suffer from hepatitis C just basic medicine so that they don't die, and they fortunately won that lawsuit. But there's been a number of lawsuits against the department forcing them to provide just basic, you know, basic care. I mean, I know of cases of women, for example, who in the prison system who have you know, lumps in their breasts, and they're growing and growing, and they're not even getting them checked until it ends up to the point that the department has to pay for them to have a mastectomy, when in fact, if they had it taken care of months earlier, they wouldn't be having to face mastectomies. I've covered young people who, you know, just basic medical care that often it's also the staff and the guards. They look at these inmates sometimes as being, you know, subhuman. And so when they say, I'm really sick, they say, you're faking it. Go back to your cell. And that causes a lot of problems, because if you don't take care of some of these illnesses early on, then you do end up getting sicker. And then essentially you end up paying more for health care than you would have had you done some preventative or at least addressed some of these issues.
I want to change things up real quickly, because there was a story from about 2 weeks ago now that there was going to be a strike, a prisoner strike, throughout Florida. And then what happened?
Well, you know, there are a lot of really serious problems facing Florida prisons. I haven't found any evidence that there's any kind of a widespread strike or even a small-scale strike. And I think I would have heard about it, because I do, whenever there's something even minor going on at some prison in, you know, the panhandle, I usually hear about it sometimes even before the department does. But, you know, that there are a lot of activist organizations whose heart is in the right place. They see all these problems and they want to do something about them. And one way they want to do it is through activism. And that's, you know, so they're making a lot of noise about this. But in reality, right now, the Florida prison system is trying its best to keep things under control. And really, the worst thing that could happen in the Florida prison system would be any kind of a massive strike or uprising. That would hurt the inmates probably more than help them, because it's only going to lead guards to be more abusive. And really, it's counterproductive. There are some serious problems, as I said, and some of the issues that they are fighting for pay for some of the work that they conduct are important, but not as important as saving people's lives.
Let me finish up with this real quickly. Is there anything right now in the Florida legislature looking at prison issues?
There's a couple of things, but nothing. I just saw that finally, they're going to allow do some kind of a referendum on whether felons could vote. As you know, in Florida, it's one of the few states now that do not allow convicted felons to vote. And, you know, there are other pending things, but nothing that's really on the front burner at this point. The most pressing issue, really, is the healthcare issue. They replaced their vendor last year. They still have issues. But no, the legislature has been pretty, there's one lawmaker, David Richardson here in Miami Beach, has been really great and pretty active in trying to solve some of the problems. But for the most part, the legislature hasn't been as active as maybe advocates think they should be.
We've been talking with Julie Brown, Miami Herald reporter. She is at the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Julie, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for the information.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, we look at one of Miami's food institutions, Jackson Soul Food. That's coming up here on Sundial, here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, if you haven't had lunch yet, you're about to get a lot hungrier. We're going to be talking about a Miami institution, Jackson Soul Food. It's been in Overtown for decades, and my guest is the restaurant's business manager, Aisha Ingraham. It's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I've been looking forward to this, and I was going through the menu earlier. I am already hungry. But let's start with a little history first. The original restaurant owned by the Jackson family was Mama's Cafe, right?
Yes, that was Charlene's parents, actually, Jesse and Demas Jackson. They owned a couple of restaurants in the historic Overtown community since 1946.
Yeah, right after World War II. I'm just curious, like, what are some of the famous stories that you've heard over the decades?
Oh, my goodness.
Which one of your favorites, if anyway?
Well, I hear so many of them, you know, how the biscuits have been, you know, so great ever since that time. Of course, you know, they passed on the recipe, I'm sure, onto Charlene. I'm sure she's done a little tweaking of her own because those biscuits are to die for. I've just always heard wonderful stories about how they've been, you know, gracious restaurant owners and always been there to be helpful towards the entire community, to give back to the residents that, you know, live in the neighborhood. And have always been there to just basically be a place to come and eat, to come and relax, to come and just enjoy yourself.
You think about what it was like way back when it was starting. This was an era when Overtown was known as like the Harlem of Miami.
Correct.
Really, I was curious about what have you been told about it? What do you know about that story, about the era back then, what it was like back then?
What I understand about the era then was it was the time when basically a lot of the artists, the musicians and things like that, that would come to Miami that would, say, perform on South Beach. And they weren't allowed to stay in any of those hotels. So they would go.
African-American performers.
That is correct. Yeah, yeah. They would go over town. They would come over to Overtown to reside, and they would actually reside at one of the hotels in town called the Josephine Dunn, as well as a few of the other hotels, and that is where they stayed, that is where they did some of their performing.
Who are some of the famous people that have come through?
Oh my goodness. Miles Davis, Josephine Baker, you name it. We've had quite a few. B.B. King. We've had quite a few entertainers come into the Overtown area.
You think about how much Overtown has changed, and it's changing right now. And, you know, how long this has been, this is an institution, it's been there so long. But how has it dealt with all those changes over the decades? Why has it survived so long?
Overtown or Jackson Soul Food?
No, Jackson Soul Food.
Well, let's see. We have, mind you, we've had a couple different locations. However, this one that Charlene opened, which she did this one without her parents. This one's actually been the longest standing organization thus far, as well as we've actually branched into other locations. We have a second location that opened up in September of 2016 in Opa-locka. And then we just recently launched another location in the Hard Rock Stadium, and we've been there for the entire season.
Let's talk about, by the way, Charlene Jackson. She opened up Jackson Soul Food, what, in the 90s, right?
Correct.
How different was it from Mama's Cafe? I mean, what, how much changed?
I wouldn't say that much changed, because, of course, when it first opened, it was a little small mom and pop store, but it has evolved over the years. She's expanded. She's, you know, made it a huge staple in the community. We have a room just for people to come and, you know, either have a meeting, have a party, and things of that nature that, you know, wasn't offered back then. And then we also offer catering services, which was another commodity that was not offered with the previous restaurants.
Why do you think this has lasted as long as it has? You know, restaurants don't last that long.
I know, but she's blessed, and I believe because she gives so much back to the community, gives back to the residents, give back to people, she, you know, is another reason why we've been around for so long, as well as the assistance that we get from the community organizations. I mean, we have the CRA, we have the GMCVB. They are all, I think, facilitate with helping us to grow as a brand. They give their services, they educate, they give, you know, rising opportunities, not just to us, but to all the other companies, restaurants, businesses that are within the community. They offer the same assistance to them as well.
But there's something unique about this place, because, again, it's been around
our
since
food is
1946.
Good. That's without question.
All right. Well, there you go. I'm trying to get to it. All right. Again, I'm talking with Aisha Ingraham. She is the business manager at Jackson Soul Food. Again, a place that has different iterations. It's been around since 1946, right?
That's right.
How is soul food different from Southern cooking?
I don't think there's much difference. I consider soul food cooking is cooking from your soul. It's the, you know, the flavors, the integration of the food and the collard greens and the candied yams. Like, you just can't resist it. But Southern food, I believe, is quite the same. I don't think that it's any difference. But for soul food, we have that seasoning, that special touch, and that's why people flock to our restaurant.
All right. So one of the things Jackson's is known for is the catfish.
That's right.
All right. How do you cook it?
Fry it. Or we can make it any way you want. We do have customers that come in that are more on a healthy kick, and if they want it grilled, we make it grilled. If they want it, sautéed, we make it sautéed. If you want it fried, we make it fried.
All right, you just said something interesting. So, you know, I've had the chance to, you know, try Southern cooking, soul food, for many years in different places, and it is high in fat. It's a lot of it is fried. But you said health. People are kind of on the health thing. Is that an issue?
No, it's not, because we do offer the variety. We do understand that some of our customers, especially more now than ever, are into keeping up their health. So with that is why we do offer the option of, you know, you don't have to come in and eat everything fried. We do give the alternative. We have salads. We have, what do you call that now?
Let's talk about the greens. You talked about that a moment ago. What are some of them?
Collard greens.
Okay.
They are not made with, they're made with turkey. So I know there's a lot of people that don't eat pork. So if they're looking for some collard greens that are not made with pork, we make ours with turkey, which is a healthier option than the pork.
Still have the same flavor? Same
flavor. It is the best flavor. It is awesome. Once you taste it, you'll see for yourself.
All right. How about the biscuits? Do you have a particular way of making them? How is that? Is that recipe lived on all these years?
Charlene gets up every day at 4 a.m. and she uses her hands, and she is at it with that dough. I keep telling her, you got to get a machine, you know, that will knead it for. She's like, no, I got to get my hands in it. And that's what she brought from her father. He did it with his hands, and she gets her hands in there, and she needs it, and she needs it, and she gets it to that point where it's so tasty. I believe it's because she's putting her heart and her soul into those biscuits is what actually makes it so good.
You know, I talked about a lot of the famous people that have come through. Now it's an institution. And so I'm just curious about, you know, who are some of the famous people you're seeing come through now? Who are the people who are coming back?
We have quite a few politicians that have come by. We've had Vice President Joe Biden. We've had the previous president, Bill Clinton. We're still waiting on Obama. apart from that, we have had some celebrities and football players. Muhammad Ali has been by there years ago with his wife. We've had many basketball players, from Dwayne Wade to his few others, some football players, and of course some other celebrities.
When did it become this famous institution? At what point did you know, like, this is not, people come to Miami and this may be one of the places they got to go stop at?
I still don't. You know when I hear other people say all the time, I don't feel famous. That's kind of how it feels. You still feel like if you're still in the midst of it doing the work, you see all this happening around you and you're like, what? And then you hear, you know, celebrities like Common on stage talking about Jackson Soul Food and go and eat our food. And then you realize, like, wow, we're really out there. Like, and then I'm hearing from other people, they're trying to find a place in Florida. And they said, you, oh my God, they're talking about your restaurant. And then you start to feel inside, like, wow, like, we really are grown. We really are that big, but you still don't feel it. You don't really feel it until someone continually comes to you and says, do you realize?
You know what? We talked about Overtown, and you think about the fact that, again, it's going through these changes. Obviously, you know, a long time ago, the highway comes in, splits up the community. So much has changed. Now we see it again, and we see it with, you know, the Bright Lines coming in. They say it's going to change things. There's going to be a soccer stadium built at some point, maybe. That could change things. Neighborhoods are changing. A lot of neighborhoods here in Miami are changing. Is that a good or bad thing?
I see it as a good thing. If the soccer stadium comes, that's, I think, a great thing. It will bring additional business and revenue to everyone, all the businesses in Overtown and in downtown. I think it's a great opportunity for everyone at this point. There is a lot of gentrification. There's a lot of different, you kind of see it rolling over. It's twofold, but we stand on our own. We've been around for over 30 years, and we provide great quality food and excellent customer service. We're ever growing as a company, as an organization, and we are growing with the community.
But you said that word, gentrification, and in some places that's a bad word. Because you're basically changing a neighborhood. You're pushing people out so that a bit more money comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a bad thing sometimes?
Sometimes it can be, but you have to kind of roll with the punches and grow with the changes.
All right, you talked about there's more than one location. So you've got the Opa-locka one. You guys are getting ready to open up in the airport.
That is correct.
Miami International Airport.
That is correct.
Where?
I can't say yet.
Okay.
The exact location, but we are finalizing everything, and we are hoping to see everything start to come into construction status this year.
All right. You had a location on Miami Beach, but it didn't work out. What happened?
It was not Jackson Soul Food. It was a spinoff of the eldest son wanted to, you know, open up a space on the beach, and he opened up what was J950, which is a spinoff of Jackson Soul Food in homage of the fact that Jackson Soul Food is on 950. So he named it J950 and partnered with a group of people that he thought it would be great business. But unfortunately, it didn't work out, and, you know, he's parted ways, but it wasn't actually Jackson's soul food.
Okay. Now, because look, you guys were on the beach last year for the South Beach Food and Wine Festival.
And we're going back this year.
You're going back this year. First, that was the first soul food restaurant to be invited, right?
That is correct.
Well, I mean, your overall take, I mean, you're going back. Was it a good, it was a good experience?
It was a wonderful experience, and I am elated to be going back this year to show off our products, to show off our brand.
What was it like when you're sitting there, you're cooking for this crowd, and you're talking about famous chefs and food critics? What was that like?
I believe that just because, you know, there's another famous chef, we're just as famous.
Oh, see, you know you're famous. Let me finish up on this. What's next for Jackson Soul Food?
Oh, the sky's the limit. We are, like you said, launching in the airport as well as looking into going into the Brightline station. And who knows wherever else we may go.
Just real quickly, though, is there ever any concern? Because when you are the small little mom and pops, when you start out, you know, you can keep those recipes and you can keep a tradition. And then when you start to branch out, isn't there a fear that all of a sudden
you nailed it on the head? Yes.
The other ones, you know what? You start to water down that, you know, what you're famous for. Is there any concern about that?
There's always that concern.
Just in all fairness, how many times can mom go in and need those biscuits in the morning for many locations?
Right, exactly. That is always the concern. And actually, that's one of the questions that I pose to her all the time. Like, what's going to happen? We have to, you know. But we're working through those processes as they come along. Because right now, we are still in the growing process. And when those situations do occur, because we have to actually prepare for it now for the airport is, you know, kind of furnishing over the recipes just a little bit, not everything, but just because we're not sending our whole menu to the airport. It's going to be condensed. So we're working with it. We're working with it.
Aisha Ingraham, again, the business manager at Jackson's Soul Food. It's such a pleasure. Aisha, thank you so much for the time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Now I'm in the mood for some biscuits.
Oh, I'll definitely bring you some.
All right. Coming up next on Sundial, the lurid opera, Salome. That's next here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, if your idea of opera is people in costume standing stiffly on stage singing to the audience but not to each other, prepare to be challenged. We're going to talk to two singers with the next Florida Grand Opera production. It's Salome. Soprano Kirsten Chambers sings the title role. Tenor John Easterlin is her stepfather, Herod. Guys, thank you so much for being here. It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're excited to be here today.
You know what? For anybody who doesn't know, all right, this is the part of the biblical story of Salome. So both of you, let's have a little history lesson, I guess, a little going back to Sunday school, perhaps. Tell us the story of Salome.
Well, starting with Sunday school in the book of Matthew in the New Testament, Herod has a party. And at the party, he requests that his stepdaughter dance for him. And she does this, and he says, if you do this for me, I will give you anything that you would like. And once she dances, he says, what would you like? Now, in the Bible story, it's his wife who says, I would like the head of John the Baptist. But in the opera, which is taken even more largely from an Oscar Wilde play entitled Salome, it is Salome, the stepdaughter, who says, I want the head of Jochanaan, which is German for John the Baptist. And it's just an interesting aside. In the Bible story, there is no name given to the stepdaughter. The name comes from a coin that was found in the unearthing of the ruins of the real palace of Herod. And in the palace was a coin, and on the coin was an imprint of a young woman believed to be Herod's stepdaughter. And on the coin, it said Salome.
And you play the king.
I play the king. It's good to be the king.
Who is this guy? How do you describe this guy?
Well, I actually have read three biographies about the real Herod Antipas. And it's important to point out, this is not Herod the Great. Herod the Great, which is a term that some people may be familiar with, is the Herod from the time of the birth of Jesus, from the Nativity story. This is his son, Herod Antipas. Herod the Great had several sons, but it was Antipas who was the one that was bestowed the next title of emperor. And the reason for that is that it was Antipas who carried out the killing of the children 2 age and under when the wise men did not come back to reveal where the Christ child was. So that alone gives you an idea at a very young age the kind of person, the terror, and the horror inside of this man. And so now as the ruler of Judea, the thing that I had uncovered, the chronicle, the Hebrew scholar Josephus chronicled the life of the real Herod Antipas, and he was by today what we would call bipolar. So on the one end, he was a great leader, obviously. He had initially run the army, but on the other end, he could question himself and he could question those around him faster than snapping a finger and think that anybody was out to get him. He would see things that weren't there. He would hear sounds that didn't exist. And he would think that those that in one moment were at his right arm and at his right side were then there to do away with him. And he would then do away with them.
Much like our Herod in this opera.
And that sets up the show. There you go. Kirsten, so you play Salome, the stepdaughter.
Yes, I
do. All right. And this is a very, as we've already heard, very dysfunctional family.
It is a very dysfunctional family. You know, Salome is just a young woman looking for love. And she's a lost woman. And she falls, you know, it's a lot in 90 minutes. One of the shortest operas. Salome falls in love. She gets rejected. And then she does a 9-minute dance, which you rarely get to do as an opera singer. And then she finally gets what she wants by making love to her lover's severed head. And then she dies. So it's a lot of emotions all happening at warp speed.
All right, yeah, there's a lot that we're going to get to here. So, you know, before we jump to all of that, you know, the opera, by the way, because mm-hmm. We were having this discussion about the pronunciation. The character is Salome.
Salome, yes.
The show, though, it is Salome, is Salome. Or am I saying it the right way? Or have I been saying it wrong all this time?
In Hong Kong, okay. Which is where English.
You performed it there for the first time,
I performed it there for the first time. They say Salome.
Okay.
That's the English version of it. So there's many different pronunciations of the name.
Look, and I feel better knowing that I can go back into, you know, with my coworkers and tell them they were all wrong. Okay. The opera is based on, as we mentioned, by the play by Oscar Wilde. So it's not surprising that the characters are very complex, but also that the story, again, lured in so many parts. This production even has adult content warnings.
Yes.
I mean, I'm just curious, like, you know, what are you telling the audience? And is this anything like an HBO special series or something? I mean, how, you know, because you don't think of opera that way.
Mm. Well, I mean, I guess actually you've just said the best thing.
Yes, you did.
About what opera is today, be today.
It can be. You know what? Let me back up too, because it's traditional opera, but then around what, the late 19th century, all of a sudden we started to see it was getting a little bit more experimental.
Well, not just experimental, but realistic, honest, something that tells the truth, tells the story, tells it in real time. I think that's another aspect of Salome, is that it's a lot coming at you in an hour and a half, but it's an hour and a half in real time. In other operas, there are multiple acts, and you may cover multiple days, weeks, years. But in this hour and a half, it is in real time. We are not jumping through an evening. It is happening before your very eyes. And the things that are happening are, while they are at times gory, highly sensual and even sexual, are realistic and they are honest. And for people today who watch a lot of television and watch a lot of Real Housewives and a lot of realistic depictions of real people going through things in real time, I think that this opera dovetails into a lot of aspects of things that happen. Not that people are necessarily severing heads on a daily basis, but there's
not anymore.
Not anymore. Not
well, I think, yeah, you know. No, you're right. I think we've seen so much already, in the media. So maybe it doesn't surprise us that much. Again, this is the performance of Zalame. It's going to be this Saturday. It opens at the Arts Center next month. It's at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. And I'm speaking with soprano Kirsten Chambers, sings the title role, and tenor John Easterlin. He is, of course, the stepfather, Herod. You know what? Interesting enough, I was looking back on the history of this show, and it had been banned in places like London and Vienna at one time. And I'd read about performers who, especially Zalame, would not perform the dance. We'll get to that in a little bit. But I mean, this was when it came out. This is just controversy, absolute controversy.
Mm-hmm. In the libretto, Herod promises to give Zalame anything she asks, as long as Zalame dances for him. Nowhere does it say she has to reveal herself to him. Of course, in the traditional dance of the seven veils, it's expected that she reveals herself. Playing Zalame, I've always thought you either do the reveal or you don't. With Zalame, there's just no halfway. And especially in our version, we're playing a very real human Zalame. She's not a caricature of a deranged woman. Our director, Bernard Uzon, is insisting that we shed our veils, so to speak, to reveal our own inner story with our characters. And so I think when I did it in Hong Kong, audiences were shocked. And it was a very subtle kind of reveal.
People know, or they've heard of the dance, this famous dance. Now, just briefly describe it as what's happening, because and I've seen different versions, on YouTube. But they're basically, the woman is unveiling herself piece by piece until, and again, different versions depend on how much she unveils. But I mean, just describe that scene.
Yes, and we're still figuring out the reveal. So you'll have to come to the show to find out what we decide to do, aren't we? Yes.
A little tease. All right, there you go. Mm-hmm.
One of the most beautiful things about our production, I think, is the dance. And it's choreographed by Rosa Mercedes. And she does, it's very theatrical, and it's for 9 minutes. And we have six veils on our dress, and then the final veil we have over ourselves. And we actually use those veils and we shed them, so to speak, throughout the dance. And we use that also to tease Herod and to, encourage him to give her what she wants, the head of John the Baptist.
When you performed it in Hong Kong, and as you said, the audiences, well, they were shocked by that.
Yes.
But I mean, you know what, as a performer though, for you, in that is that an easy decision to make, to say, I have no problem with that? Or is there some kind of conversation that's going on about how far you're willing to go?
I think as an artist, you kind of say to the universe, I'm going to live for my art. And it's your job to reveal your story inside and out. And it's funny, it almost just feels like another costume. It's your job to take the risks so that others may feel the wonder in your performance. Playing Zalame, it's the ultimate risk. But that's kind of our job. It feels uncomfortable, but it being an artist, it shouldn't feel comfortable.
As you also said, it's a dance.
And it is.
So, I mean, you have got to train for this, because opera already, look, and I'm not an opera singer, but having talked to opera singers, that is a lot of work, physical preparation you have to make. and now dancing on top of that. A lot of movement. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what's that preparation like for you?
Well, I'm actually in a book called Fitness for Opera Singers.
Oh.
Wellness is really important to me. And I also, even mental wellness, I'm also done a lot of webinars on the inner experience of the artist. So inner and outer is very important. There's a lot of inner and outer actually in this opera. But I've had dance classes since I can remember. And I did flamenco dancing and was hired to do that.
Didn't you also, because when mm-hmm. you made the debut at the Metropolitan Opera.
Yes.
Wasn't that like a last minute, or suddenly you were?
Oh, yes. Just a few hours. I was called at 2:30 that same day to do the dance, and there were, I don't know, 9 lifts. And so they said, so Kirsten, how do you feel about making your debut at the Metropolitan Opera today and singing Zalome?
I said, 2 hours.
Oh, I'm ready. What do you need me to do? And so I threw on a leotard, hopped in a taxi, got there. And the first thing that they had me do was the dance, because I had never worked with the dancers that were going to be lifting me up. I'm a tall woman. It was glorious. It was glorious. It was so exciting. And I'd never worked with the orchestra, never sung on the stage, never worked with a conductor, and nor with the actual singers. So everything was new, but there's something so in the moment and spiritual about that experience. I was never nervous, because you had to be so in the moment that you just had to think about doing your job.
Again, we're talking about the opera Salome. It is coming to the Arts Center. It is going to be next month at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts, this Saturday at the Arts Center, by the way. Talking with soprano Kirsten Chambers, singing the title role, and tenor John Easterlin, who is the stepfather, the wonderful king that we find out he is, Herod. We're going to have more on this conversation in just a moment here on Sundown WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and you're hearing Kirsten Chambers, the soprano, singing the title role of Salome. And she's joining us in studio. Also, tenor John Easterlin, who's playing the stepfather Herod, is joining us as well. Again, as I mentioned, the show is playing this Saturday. It opens at the Arts Center. Next month, it's at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. I've always found it so fascinating, just opera singers, and the fact that, look, I did a little chorus when I was in high school. I am not a singer. I'm a radio guy. It's just the power that you have to have. I always just say it. The pipes you guys have is amazing. You know what, John, I wanted to ask you about getting ready for your role, because isn't it unusual for a tenor to be a villain?
Well, yes and no. In my repertoire, I'm what's called a spiel tenor. I do all types of character roles. And so I play the gamut. From good guys to funny guys to incredibly bad guys.
You've played, let's see, what is it? Andy Warhol.
Yes.
The Witch in Hansel and Gretel. Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, no. Anybody
Larry King.
Yeah.
Oh.
So you've been up and down this. Okay. But for this particular role then, I mean, it's different from all of those. I mean, what was some of the preparation that goes into place?
Well, the biggest, I think, came the first time I did it, which was at the Vienna State Opera. And that was where I read the three biographies, because I wanted to understand who the real person was. And that was really, really helpful, because to understand the bipolar aspect of him. And working with Bernard, which is an absolute dream. I've wanted to work with him for years, and he is so clear and so incisive and so specific. In the absolute best way.
Mm-hmm.
And so he finds those moments of bringing out this bipolar shifting at all times.
He's brilliant.
It's just brilliant with all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So it just dovetails into everything that I have read about this real man who existed 2,000 years ago. And to me, that's always very important. To play the honesty, the reality of a situation, even when you're doing a fantasy character or somebody that isn't real.
I was wondering, do you ever watch anybody else's portrayal of these characters? Oh. Or do you ignore that?
Oh, no, you watch everybody.
Oh, yeah. Do,
okay.
Everybody. On YouTube, you watch every portrayal you can, the good, the bad, the ugly, everything.
Yes.
What do you, mm-hmm. what do you get from that?
Well, you get, and I'm so glad, Kirsten, what you said, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Mm-hmm. You, because even, oh, you know, you're not just looking for the best things, like you want to steal stuff. Even from the things that you that aren't exactly what you want, you learn from that. You really yes. do. You take away things that you will do either the opposite of, mm-hmm. or things that will teach you. Something will sprout out of that that you'll be like.
Because you want to make this yours, right?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. You never want it to be a piecemeal of other performances that you thought were great. You want it to be your own person.
So you've done, look, and I want to ask you about all these other things that you do in your career, but did you guys start by wanting to be opera singers, or did you fall into this? Mm. Kirsten, what about you? I mean, when did this dream come into your life?
My elementary school music teacher discovered I had a voice, and I auditioned, and I sang for the Pittsburgh Opera, Children's Chorus, and the Opera Carmen, another dance opera.
Now, this started a long time ago.
A long time. Yes, fifth grade.
Yeah.
I still have the T-shirt. And and I wanted to be Carmen. She was so powerful and sexy, and she danced, and she sang, and I felt her singing, the vibration in my bones, and in the immediacy of it. And
did you start training at that stage? I mean, obviously you sang, because you sang in that opera at that age.
I actually was part of WQED Children's Festival Chorus of Pittsburgh, and so I was taught ORF and solfege and how to sight read anything. Thank you, Dr. Jordanoff. And I continued to sing with the children's chorus there. I had to wait till I was a little older, went through puberty before I would actually take voice lessons. But yes, I think I've always wanted to be an opera singer.
John, not just opera singer, actor, magician also? Yes. Okay. I love your resume. I love your resume, dude.
The magician part came doing the console, Menotti Opera in Glimmerglass. There's a role for called the magician, and in that production, they wanted the magician to be the real thing. So I trained for over 400 hours with one of New York City's most prestigious magicians, and because they wanted me to be sort of like a young David Copperfield. So instead of doing three or four tricks as alluded to in the score, I did 54 tricks and illusions, like television magic. And it landed me in the Guinness Book of World Records, and I actually was inducted into the Magic Circle, which is for professional magicians. So if the opera career ever goes south, I'll be at a birthday party or bar mitzvah near you.
Oh, hired.
The fact that you're in the Guinness Book of World Records, I have to admit, I'm a little bit jealous. You know what, just real quickly as we wrap up, for anyone who's never seen the show, how do you describe it to them? What do you tell them about why they need to go see this show? Kirsten.
Well, I think our opera director, he explained it best, that you will be changed after seeing this show. And playing Zalame has certainly changed me.
And again, as I said, I use the word lured. It's an interesting story. John, what do you tell people?
That you will experience something very real and very honest. And if you have never seen an opera, you will not feel like you have seen an opera. You will have seen something very true to life.
Exactly.
Please just, if anything, you know, Google Zalame, watch some videos on YouTube, but learn the story itself, and that in of itself should convince you. Again, it's coming this Saturday. It opens at the Arts Center. Next month, it's at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. I've been speaking with soprano Kirsten Chambers. She sings a title role, tenor John Easterlin. Plays the stepfather, plays the bipolar King Herod. It's such a pleasure. Guys, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. Talk to you tomorrow.